And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
This morning I went outside, turned on the hose, and washed my truck. I did not take that for granted, for but by the grace of God, I could find my life changed forever by Katrina. The human tragedy is yet to be determined. The price we all pay will be staggering. Today, we get an overview of Katrina's effects, and we find out how the wild creatures in the Gulf Coast zoos coped during the storm of the ages, when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Come gather round, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone.
The times, they are a-changing. Bob Dylan's ever-prophetic words written in 1963 are filled to overflowing with meaning to us now. As a naturalist and environmentalist, it's difficult to know what really to say. I want to welcome you all back to the Wild Side News. I've been on a special assignment for the past few weeks, and it's good to be back doing this show. But it is the most difficult show I've done. This past week has been extremely difficult for me and for my friends. It's been difficult on many of us who have watched with horror the struggles for help that went on day after day after day. But who are we who watch to mention our suffering compared to those who lived through it and who must now grapple with recreating a life from scratch? I scour the daily environmental news alerts, and I found a most amazing phenomenon this past week. The environmental community has been strangely silent. And although I know why, I cannot really effectively put it into words. Those of us who love nature feel nature. We sense its power and majesty, often with a sensitivity so attuned that a butterfly can take our breath away. I felt this storm coming. A week ago Monday, I was up on the West Coast at 4 a.m. to experience what I knew was going to be a huge historic event. Initially, it was exciting to see the news people blown about by the winds, to watch the phenomenal force of nature whipping trees about like weeds. But the winds kept coming, stronger and stronger, and the stories began spreading of the size and scale of the storm. The worst fears that New Orleans would lie directly in the path of the storm were not realized, as Biloxi became the forward front of force. And then Lake Pontchartrain was discussed, and the levees, and the storm surge, and it has not stopped since then. As in all other hurricanes, the news had the pictures of thousands of cars leaving the city, headlights in the storm. And I was one of millions who wondered if I would have left, and thousands did not. And that is the story of the deluge of New Orleans, which continues as we speak. The stories of terror, fear, abandonment, and loss are literally too many to tell. And as we listen to this show, we must prepare ourselves for even greater shocks. I guess this is America's closest experience to real war. War in the homeland. I think of Hiroshima or Nagasaki. I think of the many now all over the earth who live with the terror and the hunger, the brutality and shame that now we must face each day. There are no lessons to learn yet. Those will come, and only time will write them on the future. For now, it is ours to survey the state of our chaos and pain, for that is the story of the land. We do what we can to give you a slice through the rubble as we hear from Daryl Malik Wiley, who has spent years working from New Orleans for the Sierra Club. His personal saga and perspective will take us through segments 1 and 2. In our third segment, we take a look at the region's special creatures, those forced to endure the storm held in cages, pens, and special places in the region's zoos. How do the animals do? We will get an update from Jane Ballantyne, Director of Public Affairs for the American Zoo and Aquarium Association. We hope today's show will give you real information about our nation, our people, our hopes, and our dreams to come. So now, the story of Katrina.
There is probably no effective way to encapsulate what the storm really means to us now and even in the future, not at this point. So all that we can do is try to learn as we go, and certainly someone who has had a lot of experience literally in New Orleans and Louisiana is Daryl Malik Wiley, who is joining us now from San Francisco. But he's been working in the environmental justice organizing realms in Louisiana for the Sierra Club. Daryl, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you, Sydney. Glad to be here.
Well, I don't even know where to begin. Why don't you, first of all, let's just take time to have you give us a sense of what you perceive when you think about this storm. What are you seeing since you have really firsthand info? You've been down there. Give us a little background, first of all, about how long you've been down there and kind of the realm that you've worked in and the regions that you've covered and your familiarity with that environment down there.
Right. Well, I've been in Louisiana since 1982. I moved to New Orleans at that time and have been working with communities up and down the Mississippi River from Baton Rouge south through New Orleans to Chalmette and beyond. So mainly working with poor African-American communities that are next to giant petrochemical facilities. I thought I had seen every kind of environmental tragedy, but my awareness of tragedy got so much bigger this week.
Well, give us a sense of that region. How would you define that region and its people and the nature of it? You know, there's a matrix that it's not Nebraska.
Right, it's not Nebraska. It's Louisiana has 20% of the nation's petrochemical industry. And the majority of that is along the Mississippi River from Baton Rouge to past New Orleans. It's, you know, termed Cancer Alley because of concerns about chemical emissions. But the culture of the city itself is a rich mix of people and cultures. The city, of course, was settled by the French, but the reason the French settled the city where it is because it was a Native American trade route. So they saw commerce with Native American peoples. Then you had the French. Then you had people brought in as, you know, settling German, Irish, Spanish, Canary Islands, the Philippines, unfortunately all the slaves brought in from different parts of Africa, and the latest sort of wave into New Orleans has been the people displaced after the Vietnam War, so there's a whole vibrant Vietnamese-American community there. So it's a very much a metropolitan, cosmopolitan city with so much culture and food and jazz. Everybody knows about music and food coming out of New Orleans. But it's also the strong neighborhood associations and feelings. New Orleans is a city of neighborhoods. You know, you live and you talk to your neighbors. Unlike some American cities where you don't know who lives next to you, the city of New Orleans, you know not only who lives next to you, but who lives next to them, and there's, you know, a real sense of community, and that's one reason people didn't want to leave. They were afraid for their neighbors. There was also the economic issues. 30% of the population in New Orleans lives below the poverty level, and that's mainly African-American. So you have a very poor city, and you have this natural and human catastrophe come down upon it.
And just to be fair, I'm one who believes that just because a person doesn't have a lot of money doesn't
right.
mean there's anything in any way, shape, or form wrong with them. And as
right.
a matter of fact, obviously they've been able to organize a lifestyle there that has allowed them to survive. It's
right.
not as if they're all just sitting around starving to death. They had a culture. They had a mechanism to survive down there that was a way of life.
They, you know, and it's a very rich culture. There are lots of extended families, you know, grandmothers and mothers and fathers and sisters and aunts and, you know, this extended family. And they'd have, you know, community gardens. You know, if you didn't have something, you'd go by your cousin and he'd have something to help you out. So, you know, money's not everything. And New Orleans was better at dealing with not having, you know, some of the, quote, good things by having this rich cultural heritage, and you know, you just feel the music that's come out of the town, you know, and like I said, money's not everything.
Mm-hmm. Well, now let's start getting into the story of this storm.
Right.
Where were you when you started hearing about the storm, and then how did you? What were your thoughts?
Right. Well, you know, I was in New Orleans when I first started hearing about the storm, and you know, this storm developed very rapidly in that. First projections were that it was going to cross the state of Florida and then almost turn directly north, hitting Florida again. But the storm didn't want to do that. So it kept drifting west, and the further west it drifted, the more concerned people in New Orleans and along the Mississippi Gulf Coast became. So I started... You know, the hurricane procedure, what you do, all the house plants. My wife has a green thumb. I mean, she's just amazing with plants. And they're all outside in pots, so all those have to go into the house. Then you start looking for, you know, anything that'll blow, because you don't want anything, you know, blowing, picked up in the storm and damaging somebody else's house. So you try and, you know, all the garden furniture, all the trash cans, anything, you know, took all the hoses off of the house, you know, and put them in the house and into the storage shed in the back. And so, you know, basically it's a gigantic personal cleanup job that everybody's going through. And then some folks put plywood up on their windows. We didn't have time to do that because the time frame was much compressed. Then on Saturday, I guess the mayor started calling, in New Orleans, called for voluntary evacuation and then saying that he was going to go to mandatory evacuation on Sunday. So people started filtering out of the town in large numbers, not only Orleans, but Jefferson Parish, St. Bernard, Plaquemine, all the coastal communities. And we left our home at 5 a.m. on Sunday morning. And instead of getting in the traffic of I-10, which was the major evacuation route, because I've worked up and down the Mississippi River and know all the back roads, we took all the back roads and basically did not hit traffic until we got to the Louisiana-Texas border when, because of a bridge being out, we were forced back to Interstate 10. And we were on 10 for a little while. Then we cut once again on the back roads get to my brother-in-law's house, which is north of Houston. So that's where we ended up. We displaced one of the daughters and lived in her bedroom, and my mother-in-law was in the other bedroom. So we all successfully evacuated, but then we started seeing the images of the storm, and it's just heart-wrenching. The questions of not knowing what's going on your home, and for me, the added thing of not knowing what's going on to the all the hundreds of people I've worked with through the years in their communities.
So as you were leaving, did you have a sense that perhaps this was going to be get out of control, that this wasn't
No.
there wasn't going to be a happy ending to this?
No. You know, I packed 3 days' clothes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we thought that it would, you know, maybe, because it was tended to graze more to the east, we thought didn't think it was going to be this large of an event as far as the devastation of New Orleans. And, you know, when the storm passed itself, the city did not get a whole lot of damage from wind or rain.
It's true.
And what happened was this delayed effect that impacted with the levees failing. So we didn't know when we left that we would not be back to our home for months now, or, you know, we don't know when we're going to be able to be allowed back into New Orleans.
Hmm.
And that's very, you know, my wife and I are both having, you know, waking up in the middle of the night, worrying about different things. We had a number of cats that they were neighborhood cats. They, you know, we had gotten them fixed into the vet, and, you know, they came to our house for food, but they were not inside cats. We don't know what's happened to them. There's so many different things going on, you know, psychologically. It's just there are definitely good moments and bad moments. The good moments are when I hear that somebody I know is out and safe.
There's obviously quite a bit of talk right now about the fact that many people left and many people didn't.
Right.
And that's going to be tossed around in the political realms as to, you know, what's the cause for that.
Right.
I'm just curious, which, you know, because you live there, because you have this sense, and you also have really been working with the community, perhaps more so than many who, the community that didn't leave, what do you think were their thoughts? What was their thinking? What was their reason for not leaving? There are many, I'm sure. It's totally diverse, but
right.
Give us a sense.
You know, there are a wide range of why people did not leave. You know, some, they're just economically, there was no way. It was at the end of the month. If they were on, support from the federal government, their check hadn't come in yet. So at the end of the month, you don't have no money. So you didn't have money to put gas in the car if you had a car. If you had a car, there was no guarantee that your car would make a 200-mile journey. Some cars just don't do that, you know. We're talking about 30% of the population below the poverty level. There's also folks that own a home, and that's all they've got in the world is their home and what's in it. And they were afraid that if they left, somebody might try and take what they own. There are people who are sick and ill that couldn't get out. It's a wide range of human, you know, decisions. Every person in New Orleans had to make a decision to go or not go based on their own personal experiences, knowledge, and what they were seeing on television. Some people had wrote out hurricanes in New Orleans before, and they said, no, it wasn't a problem, you know, so it's a wide range, and we'll never know all the stories because we won't be interviewing everybody.
Let's expand this out, too, because I imagine you've traveled extensively throughout Louisiana and Mississippi,
right,
and Alabama and that area. As you're hearing the reports now, what is your sense of the status or the nature of this storm to that region?
I think it's devastated the Mississippi Gulf Coast in a way that it didn't devastate New Orleans. You know, it was direct impact from storm surge and wind. And, you know, the pictures I see there of the crushed houses and the gambling casinos blown across the highway, and, you know, that's the devastation most people think about when they hear about hurricanes. What we're seeing in New Orleans is more insidious, in that we've got floodwaters contaminated with who knows what that are now becoming part of the buildings, part of any clothes in the buildings, and have probably impacted people's health who walk through the waters. So it's just, I don't know, the more I read and, you know, watch different media reports, and the more I, you know, just my personal understanding of what chemicals are in the city and in the refineries down from the city, the nation has never experienced this type of natural and human event. And how we respond to this, I believe, will set the tone for how great a country we are or aren't. If we respond with justice for all, I think we will become a greater America. If we respond with justice for the few, I think we'll be, all of us as Americans will be diminished.
Let's take a look at, I'd like to hear your perspective as you look at the region. We're going to come back to some of the specifics in New Orleans, but there are also what I suppose environmentalists have in the past referred to as certain types of hot spots that suddenly we need to be aware of. We're probably not even aware of them yet, but because you're on the ground there, because this is your realm, what would you say are some of the areas that we need to really think about? In reality, there's so many different aspects, but why don't you give us your thoughts?
Right, yeah, and I'm just, you know, I'm just getting in reports from people I've talked with and what I've seen on television, but in Mississippi, there's a DuPont facility, DuPont Chemicals, that on Friday before the storm, the in a lawsuit, the jury awarded a gentleman exposed to dioxin coming out of the DuPont plant to a $14 million settlement. Now, all the dioxin that had contaminated the waterway and this gentleman is now spread in a much wider range because my understanding is a third of the plant has been impacted negatively, and water has washed upon the DuPont facility and then taken these dioxins and who else knows what other type of chemicals out of the facility and into the environment.
And just remind listeners what dioxin really, the effects that dioxin has.
Right. Dioxin is one of the most toxic chemicals that's been made by man. And there's a wide range of health impacts that have been argued about, but some of it, and there's a whole range of different dioxins. There's a whole range of different chemical compounds that are branched under the name dioxin. Some of them are associated with cancer causing. Some of them are associated with different kind of rashes and dermatological outbreaks. And very small amounts of dioxin can cause serious impacts to living organisms.
And where is that located?
That's located, it's in Mississippi, near Pascagoula.
Pascagoula, yeah. So fairly coastal.
Yeah, the plant was actually back on the, bayou, and let me think, the name of the town, because I was talking with somebody there yesterday, DeLisle. It's DELISE. But it's called, and my Mississippi pronunciation is not great. You know, people talk about New Orleans. We don't have a southern accent in New Orleans. It's just a very cosmopolitan city, so I don't have the Mississippi accent on Toledo.
Mm-hmm. Very good. You might also help us understand, listeners understand the nature of the petrochemical industry. I mean, this is a thank God for it. You know, we all rely on these things, but this just happened to be in the way of this storm. And what are you hearing in terms of?
Well, in terms of the storm, you know, people need to understand that since the 1950s, the coastal wetlands of Louisiana have been crisscrossed by oil and natural gas exploration canals, and those canals directly led to the destruction of the marsh. The majority of America's oil and natural gas is coming from offshore Louisiana. And so that gas and oil is, there are offshore oil rigs now that pump up oil, put it into pipelines, and then it's shipped onshore for processing in Louisiana, mm-hmm. both the natural gas and the oil. So in Chalmette, which is one of the communities I was working in, there were two oil refineries. One was a ExxonMobil facility called Chalmette Refining, LLC, and the other is Murphy Oil. So those refineries get the oil either from the pipelines or from ocean-going ships that come up to their dock, and they refine that oil into our modern, you know, petroleum economy. Gasoline, kerosene, jet fuel, diesel, everything that America runs on. So,
as well as all sorts of secondary and tertiary
right.
petrochemicals. Yeah.
That, you know, there's all sorts of, you know, in Chalmette, they're just the two, oil refineries, but, you know, up the river, they're the petrochemical industries that are making herbicides, pesticides. Louisiana is rich in natural resources. It's got oil, natural gas, salt, which is the chlorides, which is one of the building blocks of modern chemistry, and sulfur. So the petrochemical industry came to Louisiana for those raw building blocks, and they also came because the Mississippi River is navigable by ocean-going ships from the mouth of the river to New Orleans, which is about 120 miles, and then further up the river to Baton Rouge, which is another 120 miles by the river. The Mississippi River is a very winding, deltaic river. New Orleans to Baton Rouge is about 80 miles on the interstate, but by the river it's 120 miles. And so you have, you know, Dow Chemical, you have BASF Corporation, you have Shell Oil, you have Formosa Plastic, you have any, you know, most every major petrochemical company or oil company has a facility in Louisiana.
Question two, from the oil derricks. Now, if a derrick offshore
right.
Derrick goes down, some people are concerned, well, you know, the oil has to get up to that derrick.
Right.
If that breaks or those pipes fissure, are there safety mechanisms to shut off those pipelines?
Right. There are different safeguards that they've got built into their oil drilling system. One, they've got valves at the sort of the seafloor that are supposed to close if they sense a break. Then they have valves up in the platform itself, and then there are different series of safety valves along the pipelines. But one of the concerns we have, the pipelines in some areas are buried, but they're designed to be buried, but they're not designed to be buried and then under 12 foot of water. So we don't know how that's impacting the hydrology of the soils and if there's causing any breakage of pipes. We've seen some of the breaking of pipes in the city of New Orleans itself. You've seen video footage of the gas bubbling up and catching on fire, the natural gas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and those pipelines are very small, going to individual houses or businesses or 3/4 of an inch or an inch in diameter. But the pipelines down in St. Bernard and other parts of Louisiana are 12 inches, 20 inches, 24 inches. So, you know, orders of magnitude larger amounts of natural gas and other chemicals.
Are you getting any reports in terms of the status then of that whole petrochemical industry where, you know, the successes and the failures?
Right. Not a whole lot. And it's part of the frustration, you know, in not being in Louisiana, I had to fly to this meeting, this national meeting in the Sierra Club, which has been planned for over a year and a half. So I have not on the ground in Baton Rouge been able to go corner state agency folks and just say, okay, tell me what's going on. I'll be doing that when I get back next Wednesday.
So what of the great city? When we return, we continue this update with Daryl Malik Wiley when your voice of the earth returns here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
At times like these, that may be the best way to introduce our next segment. You just follow the steps as they come to make it through. That's just what people in New Orleans and the Gulf region are having to do right now. Take it one logical step at a time. and the decisions are as difficult as any people have had to make. We take a look at the next steps when we return here on the Wild Side News. Welcome back. Daryl Malik Wiley continues his story as he speaks to us from San Francisco about the great Katrina hurricane.
Let's now go back to New Orleans, because, boy, there are some huge questions there.
Right.
Questions right now, of course, deal with the fact that it is still underwater.
Right.
The Corps of Engineers is trying to patch the levees. Right. And just for my information, I think there were three breaches. Two have been repaired, and there's one yet to be repaired. Is that correct?
I think so. There were two breaches in the main part of New Orleans, that's the 17th Street Canal and the London Canal, and I think both of those have been repaired. What hasn't been breached is the breach along the Industrial Canal going into the Lower Ninth Ward and the Holy Cross neighborhood, which are the neighborhoods I've worked in.
Okay. So those areas are still going to be underwater until that, and that's a huge, I think that's the biggest break.
Yeah,
too.
It is.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be time.
Well, now, all the water is contiguous. In other words, if you patch up the two top breaches, they're showing images of people, of the Corps of Engineers pumping out, or the military, either one, pumping out through these big, huge tubes,
right,
the toxic water into,
right,
Lake Pontchartrain. Is it kind of going out one area and then coming back in the other?
It possibly could be, because the Lake Pontchartrain, there's a body of water called the Inner Harbor Canal, and where they're pumping the water out of, and, you know, I don't know exactly location,
mm-hmm,
but if they pump the water out and if it travels along the lake shore toward the east, it'll then come into the Inner Harbor Canal, and it can come back into the other part of the city.
I guess what I'm asking is it just a kind of an exercise at this point to lower the water, or is it effectively lowering the water from what you're understanding?
The parts of New Orleans we're talking about are two separate. New Orleans proper, you know, even is divided by this industrial canal.
Uh-huh.
So you've got levees on both sides of it.
Hmm.
Okay, so the levees on the major part of New Orleans, you know, French Quarter, that sort of, are secure. It's the ones on the other side that lead to the Lower Ninth Ward, Holy Cross, and then into Araby and St. Bernard Parish. That side of the levee is broken.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not pumping water back into the core, if you will, of New Orleans.
I'd like to next talk about Lake Pontchartrain,
right,
what Lake Pontchartrain is, and also how it connects with the larger environment, the ocean, the Gulf, etc.
Yeah, Lake Pontchartrain is really misnamed. It should be called an estuary system because it is tied into the Gulf of Mexico through a small pass. I haven't seen any satellite photographs. That pass might be bigger now. But the lake gradates from ocean saltwater on the east side, and it becomes less salty as you go toward the west. And when it comes to Pass Manchac is a waterway that goes into Lake Maupaw, which is totally fresh water. So the lake's a system that has varying levels of salinity in it at different times of year depending on freshwater input.
So you're getting the in-wash, out-wash effect on an ongoing daily basis.
Yeah, but not a whole lot. It takes some of the scientific studies I've read in the past, as we're talking about, it takes months for the water to, you know, exchange.
Hmm.
So, and we're, you know, so I don't know.
Okay.
What's going to happen here.
Okay. Well, and then in terms of Lake Pontchartrain, what are the major sort of values of that lake?
Well, Lake Pontchartrain is a environmental success story until last week. The Sierra Club and other groups sued in the past to stop the dredging of shells out of Lake Pontchartrain. And when you dredge for shells, which you, basically take it off the bottom of the lake, you resuspend all the sedimentation. So that was stopped over 10 years ago. And the lake has been coming back archaeologically. They've been seeing all sorts of different fishes, fish species coming back. This year we had a number of manatees in the lake. We have a growing pelican population in the lake. And it was becoming clean enough to the point where they were talking about reopening beaches on the New Orleans lakefront near the University of New Orleans and further east that had been closed as public health hazards for years as places where people could go swimming in the lake again.
Mm-hmm.
So it was an environmental success story that was moving forward.
No,
and
it was
definitely set back.
Is it considered a recreational lake?
Yes. There is tremendous sailing on the lake. There's tremendous fishing industry, both recreational and commercial. A number of folks shrimp out there. So it is a very, I don't know if people have seen photographs, but, there are a number of yacht clubs. So there's that type of recreational activity. But the average citizen in New Orleans could go to the lakefront and throw his rod out, lined out in the water and catch fish.
Mm-hmm. Well, now let's continue this story, because now, unfortunately, we're faced with questions that we've never had to think about really before, and that is the horror of the fact that the waters that are contained in various areas of New Orleans are, well, why don't you tell us what your thoughts are about what's in that water?
Yeah, well, it's a big unknown as to, what levels of different chemicals are in the water, but what we can take to start with is all the gasoline stations in the city of New Orleans who got flooded and possibly leaking of gasoline. And at most gas stations you have, antifreeze or oil or all the other associated automobile fluids stored in some way. So, eventually the containers are in might break down, or if they were in the storm, they might have gotten, their plastic bottles might have gotten punctured. Then you have a Superfund site, Agriculture Street Landfill, is now underwater. Former Superfund site, the EPA quote cleaned it up. The Haywood Thompson site, which is a former state listed site of concern for herbicides and pesticides. Then, the average household in most towns, in your garage, just think about, what kind of weed killers you've got, or pesticides, fertilizers that everybody has, to make their yards green and, then what do they have underneath the sink in their kitchen? Drano's and Clorox bleaches, and so you have all these different chemicals and potentially getting into the flood water.
Mm-hmm.
And the temperature in New Orleans right now is hot, so that flood water is getting warmed up every day.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure we're having chemical reactions out there that have not been tried in a scientific laboratory, and that's all going to be pumped to the lake, so it is of concern.
That is a question, and I don't know would there be any other alternative but to do that? Are there other thoughts being discussed?
No, if somebody asked that of me yesterday, and to run that chemical soup through any kind of filtering while pumping, we're probably talking years to pump the lake out rather than months.
Mm-hmm.
Just because of physical properties of running things through filters and, to get everything out. Because you'd have to go through, activated carbon bed, and, first you have to build the activated carbon bed, then you probably want to go through reverse osmosis to get out different herbicides, so it's a very, getting those type of toxics out of water is very hard to do.
Well, unfortunately, what is going to happen is the fact that this toxic mess is going to head down the drain, down the water system, and I don't know what else we're supposed to do. Are you hearing anything? I'm sure some people are discussing what that may mean along the Gulf area, because that's where it's going to end up.
Yeah, I haven't heard yet, and you know, I'm hearing new things every hour. So you know, maybe next hour I will hear something about what's going on along the Gulf Coast.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and then let's talk about at this point, I don't know. You hear the predictions change all the time from 30 days to 80 days to pump up the water. What's the current number?
Yeah, I haven't heard today's number.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I know that they're pumping now, but I don't have any idea of when they're going to have all the water out.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about when they finally get that done.
Right.
It's going to be a process. There's going to be various portions of the city are going to be uncovered at different levels, at different times. What do you see as where do people go from there at that point?
Well, I think that's the $64,000 question. What type of process is going to be involved in allowing people back into the city, understanding that the houses that have sat under flood water, you know, there's serious questions about, you know, how contaminated they are, what kind of contaminants have been picked up into the clothes in the house, the carpets, I think we as a country are entering uncharted waters as how to deal with cleaning up this city.
It's almost like a personal decision, although I think the government will have to make the decisions about whether or not to expose people to what very likely will be extremely toxic conditions.
Right. And what I want to advocate for as an environmental justice organizer is make sure we have some kind of justice for all the citizens of Orleans and St. Bernard Parish and Plaquemine and the Mississippi Gulf Coast, is that we just don't go in with bulldozers and bulldoze everything and turn out the lights. And that's not the America I want to live in. There's got to be some process whereby we might have to bulldoze, but we rebuild. And it's an opportunity to rebuild smarter and more intelligently than we have in the past. And we should really think about making New Orleans a premier environmentally friendly city by the way we rebuild our communities, by the way we add transit options, by the way we build in more green space, by the way we continue this historic neighborhood cultures in New Orleans. So there's a whole, if we're really visionary and really think this through, we have an opportunity here to build hope for the 30% of people who live below the poverty level in getting them jobs to help rebuild their community and then take those job skills on into the future.
It really is going to take a unique form of vision to be able to define another working version of New Orleans, because I have to believe that whole areas of the city are pretty much going to have to be redone.
Yes. I think that, what the Sierra Club is trying to pull together, and that's one reason I'm here this weekend, is how the National Sierra Club's going to respond to this and how we're going to help the local communities revision their view of what they want their communities to look like. And I've heard Governor Blanco of Louisiana mention that she wants to make sure that the citizens of Louisiana are involved in the rebuilding of Louisiana. And what we want to make sure does not happen is that the multitudes of federal dollars, the billions of dollars they're talking about using to rebuild New Orleans and the Mississippi Gulf Coast, we don't want that to be a economic infusion into the Bechtels of the world or the Brown and Roots of the world or the Halliburton of the world, that it's a sort of a transfer of federal funds into large corporations that then rebuild New Orleans in a cookie-cutter manner. We want to make sure that money goes back to the directly impacted community and they come out of this bigger, better, healthier, stronger than they were before.
I guess, it's a bit premature to really suggest what we've learned. But I think the one message that keeps coming clearly to me is the fact that this vision of globalization, centralization of control from the top, may not work so well economically, and then even in terms of just responding, that perhaps, you know, diversifying and really regionalizing and giving control more back to people so that they can make the decisions they need to in a timely fashion. I don't know, it also relates to what you just talked about. We certainly are hearing that, for example, Halliburton may have contracts already to rebuild certain areas. And maybe it's time for us to take a little deep breath and reconsider some of those things so that true economic and social justice can reach out to the people and make sure that they have a means to rebuild, an economic basis for a future, and that they can be reskilled and again take ownership of their community in a way that maybe this is, it's never a blessing, but maybe part of that lesson is to give us, as you say, this opportunity to craft new ways of creating our future.
Right. And I think it's a challenge of American democracy. You know, right now, the response we've hearing, you know, the response was tied up in bureaucratic red tape and worried about having Form 24X filled in rather than dealing with the tragedy. So I think this is a real test of our American democracy to go back to our roots of the Declaration of Independence, that we believe that all people are created equal and are endowed by their creator certain rights, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. And I think we're going to be seeing in the next few weeks and months a challenge to live up to that American dream for everyone in the affected area.
You know, there's a haunting image that keeps coming back. It's an unusual haunting image, and that was when I was growing up, there were civil defense centers almost everywhere.
Right.
You know, it was a distributed system of neighborhoods and communities taking care of themselves. And I keep wondering if that system were still intact. They, you know, every school and other places were centers where there was a sign outside, you'd look for that, you'd head for that, they'd be stocked with food. All of that was dismantled. I really think it might be time for us to reconsider a new form of civil defense.
I think you're right. Mm-hmm. And I would hope that we learn from this disaster how to respond better in future natural disasters. You know, there are two hurricanes brewing in Atlantic right now. So I know that when they rebuilt Florida the last time, they did strengthen building codes. So we need to be thinking, you know, those things. But while we're rebuilding, thinking building codes, we need to add in the added environmental component of energy conservation, energy effectiveness, transit options. Every house in New Orleans should have a solar hot water heater.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and really, that helps cut our dependence on foreign oil, which is something that we should be doing all the time, to become an America that's independent from this foreign oil and how it is causing policy options that are not environmentally sound.
Darrell Malik Wiley with the Sierra Club has been talking with us. He lives thank you, in New Orleans. Here's a thought, a couple more thoughts here. One, what is the wisdom of rebuilding the city at its present level, below sea level?
Right.
What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think we need to put that on the table and talk about, you know, possibilities. You know, where I live is above sea level because I'm close to the Mississippi River. So we need to think about, you know, there's a whole range of things to be thought about as far as how we're going to rebuild New Orleans. And I don't know all the answers now, and I don't think anybody does, but we need to have the public discussion and debate in a democratic way so it's not coming down from somebody in D.C., you will rebuild like this. So that, I think that's going to be part of the challenge.
Anything else that you want to share before we move on?
No, I know that the National Sierra Club website is going to have information about how to help get involved, so they can just check the sierraclub.org site, and we're hoping for a statement to come up by our national president, Lisa Rindstrom, at the Sierra Club Summit this weekend.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm hoping that we can really get some information back to the people next week from that summit. Daryl Malik Wiley, I want to wish you strength.
Thank you.
And glad to hear that your family is intact, but then you have your friends and your community and your country that you're concerned about.
Yes.
I want to thank you personally for taking this time to really give us this this very in-depth perspective. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
To make it through, we are going to have to redefine the nature of our nation. We have a long, winding path to recovery, and the words of the poet may give us direction.
It's a hard rain is gonna fall. Oh, what did you see, my
friend? Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
The story of Katrina is just beginning. The human tragedy is so profound, it overshadows almost all other stories. And yet, when all things sort out, the next story will hold its place in the future of the Gulf. It's hard to imagine the level of total destruction wrought by the wrath of Katrina. The size alone is staggering. If you wish to feel the extent, take a map of the U.S., trace out an outline of Minnesota, cut it out, and place it over your area. Then try to sense that everything lying within that range is leveled. In weeks to come, we will bring you updates on the nature of the storm's damage to the wild places, to bayous and estuaries, the forests, lakes, and river systems. But there is a story buried deep in the emerging legacy of the Katrina Chronicles that I was able to ferret out. I was imagining the degree of loss and wondered what had happened to the zoos in the Gulf states. I called the American Zoo and Aquarium Association to find out. And this is what we can report.
The devastation in the Gulf Coast is of epic proportions, and we hear the stories endlessly, as we should, about our fellow friends and family and our literally our American people who are suffering so greatly right now in the Gulf area. But of course there's many other stories as well, and we are going to hear in the months ahead, I'm sure, about the devastation that this has caused to the wild creatures and the forests and the rivers and as well the pets and friends of our human species. But one of the things that I began to wonder about was, what about the animals that are the captive animals that serve us so well in bringing about this awareness and appreciation of the wonder of the wild, specifically in the zoos? Here are animals that are there for us with keepers, and I began to wonder. So I made a call to the American Zoo and Aquarium Association, and on the phone now is Jane Ballantyne, who's the Director of Public Affairs. Jane, welcome to the Wildside News.
Thank you so much for calling me. I appreciate it.
Well, I began to try, you know, as we hear about all the devastation, the floodwaters, the surge, et cetera, I began to wonder how in the world would the zoos deal with this, and we've had a chance to talk, and I've done some research, and there's kind of an amazing story. There's some good news that's coming out, specifically as it relates to the zoos. Why don't you try to give us a sense of sort of what that status is at this point?
Well, we have been in sporadic communication with our colleagues down at the Audubon Zoo, as I'm sure everyone knows from the countless media reports. Communication with folks inside the city is very, very difficult. But the Audubon Zoo did have a very comprehensive hurricane plan in place. They have had for many years, obviously, with all the activity out there and being where they are located, this is a contingency that they have to really prepare for. They had a team of 12 folks who stayed at the zoo, you know, during the hurricane while the other folks evacuated the city, you know, heeding the call of the mayor and other authorities. You know, the day after the hurricane, we were all really watching and wondering, and it seemed that, boy, miraculously, there had been damage, of course, with trees and other, you know, structural damage, but it seemed that New Orleans had fared pretty well. Unfortunately, then we had the levee break, which really changed everything for them. The zoo is actually in a part of the city which borders the Mississippi River. So they were in one of the farthest areas from Lake Pontchartrain and the levee breaks. The zoo is also on some of the higher ground in New Orleans. It's still below sea level, but it is more elevated than other areas. What we have learned to date is that the zoo had hurricane damage from the winds and the rain, a lot of downed trees, and that sort of thing, but the structures are sound. They were built very well. The staff that stayed faced no problems from the hurricane itself. Certainly they had a stockpile of food for the animals and for the staff, which, of course, as time goes on, you know, the supplies are dwindling. We have been able to get a couple of truckloads of supplies now into the zoo so that they are able to replenish needs for the animals, veterinary medicines as necessary, as well as some fresh food, water, all those very important things. And, you know, we're encouraged by the fact that the flooding did not reach the zoo. They were really very blessed in their positioning. A lot of luck goes into this, but also a lot of hard work and prep on the part of the team.
Not to in any way diminish the horror that is New Orleans right now, but this is a fortunate break for this specific facility and the people there. It's just a lucky reality. What type of preparation are you aware of that they were able to make prior to the storm?
Well, some of the things that we're aware of go to the, you know, having supplies on hand, having fuel for generators, you know, anticipating that they would lose electricity. So making sure that they had fuel for generators that could then, you know, power up refrigerators. Certainly a lot of the buildings work on electricity and being able to, you know, open back up some of these areas so that on the chance that animals can be put outside for certain amounts at the time, you know, that is very, very helpful. Food supplies for the animals, keeping track of those, as well as, you know, let's not forget you need a lot of water for, you know, 1,400 animals, and you need a lot of water for people as well, and food supplies for the staff. They had put aside things like, you know, flashlights, extra batteries, satellite phones, sleeping bags, change of clothing, so that, you know, the human needs were accounted for along with the animals. The other things that are great to, you know, you have them on paper, and they do rehearse things like this. You know, give practices for any kind of, you know, emergency plan. But knowing, obviously, the behavioral aspects of each of the different species and knowing where the best place for them to be is in the case of a hurricane. As I've understood it, you know, certainly you're going to put elephants, jaguars, you know, tigers, you know, gorillas. You're going to make sure that those animals are safely inside night quarters, buildings that are structurally sound and built for hurricanes. There are some animals, certain kinds of birds, cranes and flamingos, that are much more stressed when put into a small enclosed space, and it's better to leave them outside. They're aerodynamic, and they hunker down, and it seems that that strategy worked very, very well for the zoo.
That's amazing. That's really some foresight. Any stories yet on observations of how the animals reacted to the storm?
Well, of course, I'm getting this, you know, third and fourth hand, but what I'm understanding is that the animals, of course, are recovering probably more quickly than the humans in terms of just moving on. It's another day, and you know, they're being cared for, they're being fed. Yes, their routines were disrupted, but their basic needs are being met. They are, however, having a problem with the helicopters and other low-flying aircraft. You know, these kinds of apparatus aren't normal. I mean, in their daily lives, they're not seeing that many helicopters fly low over the zoo. And so while, of course, you couldn't be happier that the National Guard and all of the folks who are in there helping people are there, that kind of disturbance really does affect the animals. They get a little stressed. So I know that they're really keeping a close watch on that. It's not something that you could predict easily, but it is something they are looking for, and to make sure that the animals aren't unduly upset by the noise and the aircraft.
So there's actually a number of components to the Audubon animal centers down there, the zoo. There is also the Audubon Aquarium of the Americas, which apparently did not fare as well.
That's correct. Structurally, the building of the Aquarium of the Americas is fine. It's on the riverfront area near the French Quarter. It did not flood. However, the electricity was out. Their backup generators, while they worked, they did run out of fuel at a certain time. Plus, the area where the aquarium is was certainly a site of a lot of the early looting, a lot of the violence that was unfortunately occurring after, you know, folks were evacuated from their homes. So the decision was made to evacuate staff from the building. They did have to leave their critters behind. However, the good news is they've been able to get staff back in there, and they are working right now to prepare some of the animals to be moved out to other facilities. You know, good news is that King Midas, who is a 250-pound sea turtle, he's doing well.
Great.
Penguins, sea otters, they have some parrots, macaw parrots, a few other birds of prey. They are all going to be moved out. They're all doing fine.
Mm-hmm. Great.
The sad part is, and I know this is heartbreaking to a lot of folks and the staff, they did lose most of their fish. I don't have numbers or a count, but most of the fish, because of the life support systems, were not active. They did lose most of that collection, and I know that's pretty devastating for folks.
Collections are extremely difficult to replace. Very time-consuming and costly, and just frustrating because these are valuable creatures, in some cases rare and hard to find. Let's continue talking about them. Are there any specific needs that you're hearing from them that listeners and others may be able to assist with?
Well, at this time, there has been a huge outpouring of support from the zoo and aquarium community, and we here at AZA are coordinating lists of supplies that are being requested. You know, for the aquarium specifically at the moment, there isn't anything that they're in need of. They are, as I mentioned, working to remove the living collection and place them in other facilities. So that's being handled right now. We did, you know, AZA has set up a fund along with, you know, many, many other groups. And we're hoping that this fund will be able to collect monies that will help support the staff and their families as they, you know, come to grips with what is left of their homes and their belongings. A great thing that's occurring is the offer of jobs for a lot of folks who may be out of work for quite some time at other zoos and aquariums around the country. So I think if folks would like to do something, You know, certainly, you know, the Red Cross is a wonderful organization. Other humanitarian organizations, we say support those. If you'd like to specifically support the zoo and the aquarium in New Orleans, we have set up a fund through the Lincoln Park Zoo that they can certainly donate to if they choose.
And what's the best way for them to go directly there and assist?
The easiest way to do that is to go to www.lpzoo.org, and there is a spot right on the website where folks can make a donation.
And then also, why don't you give your website at this point?
Absolutely. We're posting updates daily as we get them, not only on Audubon Zoo and the aquarium, but also on some of our other members who were relatively unscathed, but certainly in the path of Katrina. And that address is www.aza.org.
Well, on your website, when people go and they look at the hurricane update, they're going to find some interesting news about the rest of the region. So as you can, why don't you, if you could, just give us a brief summary of some of the news about the other zoos in that region.
Well, certainly. The other zoos, you know, specifically in, you know, Mississippi, Alabama, and Louisiana, all fared fairly well. Certainly we had our hopes and prayers with them as well during the actual hurricane. We'll start closest to Audubon, Baton Rouge Zoo. They had a lot of downed trees and some, electricity was out for a while, but they are up and running. As a matter of fact, folks at Baton Rouge are really helping to coordinate supplies and get them into Audubon. So they're just amazing. They have the Alexandria Zoo, which is in Louisiana. They were closed for a day or two, and they are back up and running, no loss of animal life. The Jackson Zoo in Mississippi was closed for a little over a week. They had some major tree damage, a lot of downed power lines, but they are now reopened. They did not lose any animals, and they are feeling, you know, very, very lucky right now. The Birmingham Zoo in Birmingham, Alabama, and the Montgomery Zoo in Montgomery, Alabama, both lost electricity, had some debris spread around, but did not have any loss of animal life. The zoo in Gulf Breeze, Florida, they are kind of up in the Panhandle area. They had minor damage, no loss of animals, and they are open for visiting. And lest we forget, you know, Katrina started out in the Atlantic and came across the Miami-Dade area. The Miami Metro Zoo is now open. They opened up on Saturday the 3rd. They do have some cleanup yet to do. You know, a lot of water was dumped in that area from the rain, but they as well report no animal loss.
That's absolutely, the bottom line is, and this is really almost miraculous, and that is that within that whole region, in terms of the zoos, the major loss was at the Audubon Aquarium because of a loss of electricity, but quite honestly, almost all the other zoos are literally open. That's extraordinary.
It really is, and I'll tell you, you know, AZA requires as part of accreditation that you have emergency plans in place for, you know, we'll say natural disaster, because each part of the country might have something different they need to expect, you know, earthquakes in the west and hurricanes around this area. But we also really require that they practice drills on these different plans, so that people, you know, when emergency happens, you need to be able to respond pretty quickly and get things taken care of. We are lucky in this country with the weather systems that we have. There's people telling us what's coming, and we can plan and prepare. So the other thing that I think is such a hallmark of folks who work in zoos and aquariums, I mean, they're all committed to the animals. They're very passionate about what they do, but they're also passionate about helping out each other. So when somebody might take a look at their hurricane plan, for instance, and think, well, you know, based on some things that happened last year, certainly poor Florida got hit several times, let's see if there's lessons learned from those folks that we can incorporate into our plan. And our community is willing to share all of that information, because, you know, really, it's It's to benefit the animals in the long run, and that's what's most important.
I'm just curious now, with the zoos, I can imagine the people in that region may be contacting their local zoo as they can to ask how they might better care for their pets or animals. Are you hearing any stories about that type of assistance from the zoos out to the community?
I haven't yet, and I think a large part of that is due to groups like the ASPCA and the Humane Society of the United States. They have such a great focus on companion animals and how to, you know, prepare for emergencies and how to care for their animals. I think, you know, we refer people to those folks because that's really their expertise. And it's so hard too, because, you know, there's probably a loss of life in New Orleans that may not have occurred if people were able to get out and move to places with their animals. I hear that a lot, that you know, I don't want to leave because I can't take my dog with me. Or, you know, I can't bring my cats, and who's going to care for them? I couldn't leave them behind. You know, those are things that are really tough to prepare for. But certainly if folks ask, we'd do the best to help them any way we can.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank God the zoos have been blessed, really. I don't know how else to put it. They just were spared somehow the wrath of this storm. I know that you'd like to share some thoughts to the whole region there, from the American Zoo and Aquarium Association out to not only your allies and friends, but also to the region.
Absolutely. You know, these storms hit all of us, or these tragedies hit all of us in a different way. And while certainly in our community we have great friends and colleagues in New Orleans who have you know, they've lost their homes in many cases. Their lives will be disrupted for, gosh, who knows how long. But our thoughts and prayers are not only with them, but everyone who's been affected by Katrina. It's so overwhelming, and I can't pretend to know what it's like for those individuals. But, you know, I can certainly pass on the hopes and prayers of those of us who are watching and trying to do what we can to assist.
We're talking with Jane Ballantyne, Director of Public Affairs with the American Zoo and Aquarium Association. Jane, as you go into the future here, what can people expect to see on your website, and how will you help to keep them informed?
Well, we're going to continually get updates. I think as hopefully as things progress in New Orleans, you know, when communication systems are more reliable, we'll be able to put up some additional, you know, information. Hopefully we'll be able to get it more quickly. Next week, the AZA has our annual conference. We'll be in Chicago for a week, and we are hoping to, you know, continually update folks in Chicago and get these updates on our website, so that all the people who've been so kind and calling and emailing and asking how they can help, we want to make sure that everybody can understand what's going on and see how things are progressing.
Jane Ballantyne with the American Zoo and Aquarium Association. That's www.aza.org. Jane, I want to thank you so much for giving us this update and sharing this good news in such a tragedy. Thank you.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much, and we appreciate all the sentiments that are coming in from everywhere. It's very heartwarming.
Lately, our nation has been reeling from the effects of a low-grade political hurricane that has kept things all caught up in the giant spin zone of power. We have been shown what real power is and what real power can do. We can all hope and pray that we will please heed the call for the wild and the wild places, the spirit of freedom, and this nation that has carried for so long the mantle of justice now faces the challenge of our lifetimes. It's time to heed the warnings, come together as was always intended, and make this nation whole again. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios, peace, and tolerance until we meet again each Thursday when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
And admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. Oh, the times they are a-changin'.